Hello, welcome to the Saxo Market Call. It is Tuesday, October 22nd. We've got a lot going on with Brexit today. I think finally we're going to get some kind of decisive vote after all of these delays. And yesterday, the so-called meaningful vote, not allowed by Bercow in the UK Parliament. But today, we can't avoid a vote. It looks like we'll get one. I believe it was 7 p.m. local time was the time I saw anyway. And you can see on slide one in today's slide deck a few things here that's very complicated. I haven't even managed to reduce it much. This little list of things is just a very, very rough outline. There's a lot of little ins and outs here. But the key, of course, is today's second vote, which is still a go-no-go on Johnson's Brexit deal. If it is a no-go, if it does fail, we probably go straight to an election scenario. We already have Johnson's, albeit unsigned, extension request in place, and we'll get some sort of election scenario, and then a new round of whatever happens next. But if we do get the vote, and apparently the votes are there, enough Labour votes there in favor of Johnson's deal to just push it over the edge, there is the risk that the second vote after that will be, which will be on the timetable, which has to be extremely compressed to get this done before this October 31st deadline. There is the risk that vote fails, in which case we'll have a number of amendments, including those on potentially on the customs union, keeping the UK in the customs union, which Boris Johnson is against. Also ends up in an election scenario and that delay to, of course, at least till January. So I think election odds very high regardless, because if Johnson wins here, gets it all done, he'll want to strengthen mandate within Parliament. If he's not getting what he wants, you know, it's a question of he throws his hands up and says, look, I got the deal, and it's Parliament's fault that it didn't pass, so we need to go to an election to give myself a mandate either way. So that's where we are. If you look at the next slide, euro sterling, you can see we've been pressing towards the highs in sterling here, and you can see roughly where the range has been. That 85 area was the best you saw in sterling, more or less, since the Brexit vote. There was a brief period of around 83 back in early 2017, but the gap really is back towards 80 to 81. So that's your theoretical potential. I'm not sure I can do all of that on today's vote and a clear progress towards Brexit, but certainly a risk that we explore that sort of gap range between 80 and, let's say, 83 to 85 in euro sterling, keeping the dollar out of the equation because the dollar's been quite weak here. Other big news yesterday, we saw Trudeau winning in Canada, albeit with a weakened mandate. So not a huge news item for Canada or the Canadian dollar. But if you look at slide three, you're seeing a dollar Canada, which is, you know, moved quite rapidly lower towards that key 130 area. And you can see the key driver here is the two-year rate spread, U.S. to Canada, which is down towards the lowest it's been in quite some time, where the Canadian two-year rates are actually above those of the U.S. by some 30 basis points, at least for the swaps. And that is driving a much stronger Canada. I think I scratched my head a little bit at the extreme this has reached, but the market is really geared for Canada to do quite fine. And certainly no Canadian recession or concerns about a credit crunch or housing crisis there. So I scratch my head a little bit, but it is what it is. And it's fair that you could say the dollar Canada movement is fair in terms of market pricing relative to where that spread has gone. Now, I forgot to introduce our my fellow colleague in the studio today, Peter Gonry in equities.
Hi, John.
Apologies for that, Peter. Nice. And we've got plenty going on in the equity markets this week in the heart of earnings season and some of the massive trillion-dollar companies out there reporting earnings this week.
Exactly, and if we start in Europe, we have UBS this morning delivering better results than expected, higher net inflow of AUM, beats on the bottom line almost by 10% against the expectations. So, if you look at chart five on UBS, or slide five, sorry, I mean you can see a share price that have been absolutely battered over 2 years. It almost it's been halved. And the last time I checked, I think the UBS shares were up 3% in pre-market. So investors are really, really enjoying this. It could potentially be an inflection point here for you, for European financials, if others can follow UBS lead. However, keep in mind that UBS is a very wealth management centric oriented financial firm. And as you said, John, we have some mega caps reporting this week, and I wrote a small update on Amazon and Microsoft yesterday, which you can see on our Market Insights page on home.saxo. And as you can see here, what I actually write is that I think it takes good results from Amazon and Microsoft to pull the S&P 500 into a new high. The highs are around 30.27, 30.29-ish level. and so we're around, you know, around 18 points away from that area. And Amazon and Microsoft are combined market weight of around 7.2% for the S&P 500, so hugely important. Microsoft will report after the market close on Wednesday, so that's tomorrow, and Amazon after the close on Thursday. And you can read my analysis, but basically I focus most on Amazon because technically Microsoft is extremely strong and I expect a solid beat from Microsoft. I think Amazon is more a 50-50 case. Could they actually disappoint and take sentiment lower here? So so Amazon, really watch that one on Thursday. It's the most important one.
Also, relative to the broader market, if I recall, last time I looked at an Amazon chart, it's a bit underperforming. What are the specific concerns around Amazon? Is it about margin pressures or the inability to realize that profitability that was supposed to be coming all along?
Yeah, it's down 14% from the highs, and it's actually almost 1.5 years time since they had a previous high, which is quite unusual for Amazon. It has been a momentum stock. Yes, John, you're right. I mean, there are questions about whether we were beginning to see a margin squeeze. We're already seeing it in their international operations and not growing as fast as they do in North America. So the whole Prime concept is not really taking hold in their international business on the e-commerce side. Amazon Web Services is still a monster business. It's $30 billion, profit margins of 60%. But Microsoft and Google are really fighting for market share in that area. So I expect profit margins to come down over time. So a lot of focus on the margin picture and whether there is actually a slowdown. As I talked to a journalist this morning, and I said, if you look at Amazon, the growth rate just alone in the past two quarters on a 12-month rolling basis has actually come down from around 30% to 20%. So it seems like there is a material slowdown happening in Amazon.
And another thing, actually, you know, I think one key pressure point across markets, and one thing that's been developing the narrative so much across markets are, you know, benchmark rates, especially the longer rates, and that of course is very important for valuations for equities as well. And we're seeing quite a persistent rise here in rates. Now, I would argue that it's becoming a much bigger factor if they go much higher. So if we look at the U.S. 10-year rate, we've reached up to 1.8%. We're still in the range that was established on the previous rise in yield. That peaked out at 1.9% after we established that incredible low for the cycle. I would argue the game changer might be something like 2% on 10-year yields. I think you're starting to wonder what is driving valuation, or at least multiples, unless we're getting really good news from the economy, if there's the sense that yields are rising above 2%.
I think in general, I think the lower rates in the long end of the yield curve have definitely helped equities. So if you don't see equities come down, if we see the 10-year 2% or slightly higher than that, it would be very unusual. I can't even understand what it would take. It would probably something along the lines of significantly improving macro conditions. But I think you're also referring to the chart I have here on slide 7, which I posted on my Twitter account yesterday. And we had 17 and now it's down to 13, but we have $13 trillion of negative yielding bonds in the world. And I've highlighted with gray areas the two sort of main periods where you had a...
But before, let me just interrupt you there. It's not just about negative yielding per se. It's also about negative real yields. And I think that's...
Negative real yields.
That number is even larger because... It's even larger. CPI is still positive in a lot of these places that have... Yeah. Whether the rates are slipping slightly above or slightly below zero. So I think it's just the whole... super low yields rather than just the nominal amount of actually negative yielding.
I think that's a very great point, John. But if you look at those two periods where you had a substantial decline in interest rates, it's very key. It's a very interesting observation here, and that is that the valuation spread between what we call minimum volatility stocks and the general equity market, in this case S&P 500, widened substantially in those two periods, and specifically the period from Q4 2018 until late August this year, we've seen a massive expansion. And minimum volatility stocks have been the best performing asset class together with private equity by far. It seems like I at least think there is some kind of a substitution effect. So when you can't get any real yield on your bonds, you sort of pivoting towards equities where you have stable returns and stable dividends, sort of echoing what Bill Gross has been saying lately in the Financial Times. So I think that is really a real trend that is going on. Before we go to the calendar, just want to highlight that some of the positive earnings we had last week meant that the S&P 500 forward estimates on earnings per share actually was increased a little bit yesterday. So I think that's also adding to the positive story that we're seeing in equities.
Yeah, one of the reasons I point out the 10-year is I think it's a mover of all markets. I mean, remember last year when U.S. 10-year was going above 3%, it was basically breaking the world across the board. And I would argue that above 2%, it's starting to become a game changer. You know, why did we crash in yields? Were we supposed to be predicting in a bad economic outcomes? What does this mean? I think it's just a key indicator to look at across markets. On the calendar front, very little on the macro side. There's at 10 o'clock. There's a number of these UK CBI trends. These have been absolutely awful. I wouldn't expect those to improve. But of course, we're all focused on Brexit headlines. Just to keep in mind that the momentum in the UK economy is absolutely terrible. So we need to see strong confidence, strong capital flows returning to offset what are built-in risks on the downside for the UK economy because of all this uncertainty and our measures of the credit impulse, which have been at record lows or at lows for a record period of time, shrinking actually for quite a few months. And then Canadian August retail sales, maybe a potential blemish there for Canada, which has really been on a roll lately, almost unparalleled with other currencies. Minor manufacturing survey out of the US and existing home sales. Nothing to write home about. But tomorrow, a bit more interesting, we have the Riksbank. I think there may be a little bit on hold and commenting too much. There was a recent Swedish statistics agency that came out and said, you know what, we think we're not our data on the unemployment rate is actually not very accurate and is probably underestimating the strength in the labor market. You've seen short Swedish rates come back up higher aggressively. Eurostoxx looking getting close to a technical breakdown. I think this meeting tomorrow likely, whatever guidance is provided, is the do or die for whether Eurostoxx can fully break down. I would argue the backdrop here, very strong risk appetite, the euro recovering a bit, and everything looking up at the moment is about as supportive for the Swedish krona as you will get. ECB meeting, I think, given all the news and signs and reports of total division on the ECB Governing Council, I expect a zero out of this meeting in terms of signals that we can take. It's all about the changeover November 1st to the new leadership, and we'll be watching, of course, for developments from there.
But it is interesting. It's the final meeting for Mario Draghi, so he's leaving the ECB now. This is his final press conference. And he's leaving an ECB that is shattered in terms of consensus, right?
Yeah,
I mean,
exactly.
You have two very divisive camps inside the ECB.
Yeah.
And as you and I have talked about, and also Steen, I mean, it will be extremely interesting next year what will take place inside the ECB. Where will Lagarde take ECB? Will she take interest rate back to zero because she's forced by the Germans, or at least argued by the Germans to do so? And will that mean that we'll have some offset by fiscal measures?
Exactly, offset by fiscal would be a key element of being able to take it back to zero. But yes, big stakes here, but whether we get to actual policy initiatives or indications out of that is the question. Now, I pointed this out yesterday, and we did see this recent headline, Trump talking about, we're on target for a November deal. We'll see. We've been here before with Trump indicating this, indicating that. But it's we have an interesting speech. Again, just want to remind people to tune in on Thursday. Did I say tomorrow? By the way, if I said tomorrow on the Riksbank meeting, ECB meeting, it's not tomorrow. It's Thursday. Today is Tuesday, so this is not. These are not until the day after tomorrow. But that Thursday speech from Vice President Pence on China, he's been playing the bad cop in the so-called good cop bad cop setup, and I would suspect, without knowing, that this could be a bit of a damper on enthusiasm about U.S.-China relationships improving. I suspect something a bit aggressive. We'll see. Could be a market mover, especially at these levels, and I would assume some of the pricing in the market is that we're hoping to get at least a narrow deal on trade, in addition to getting Brexit taken down. Was there anything you want to highlight earnings calendar for today before we close
it? Yeah, I have actually highlighted United Technologies. That's because we know industrials have been weak. They're part of the slowdown in the global economy. And then I'll probably highlight Procter & Gamble, simply because we still have some doubts about how strong is the consumer in the U.S. So any guidance or small glimpse of what's to expect for next year from Procter & Gamble on the consumer side, I think it could be actually a quite interesting macro takeaway.
The U.S. consumer is certainly key for the state of the U.S. economy, so that's a great microcosm maybe of what's going on in the broader economy from their words. Okay, we'll leave it at that. We'll be back tomorrow with the Saxo Market Call. Thanks for joining.